You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Fran reading from The Sun of January 3rd, 2006, and on to a new year and a new front page with a very nice salacious story at the top of the page that most listeners will find interesting. It's about all the millionaires that are the top paid 10 in the state of Massachusetts, all coming from the UMass system. This, written by a Boston Herald reporter, Tim Dunn, gives his email address as tim.dunn, that's D-U-N-N, at bostonherald.com. It says that for the 18th year, we delivered the Your Tax Dollars at Work tally of where your money is spent in Massachusetts. This comes out annually. All the public employee pay comes straight from the controller's office, and that data was updated this last Friday. The UMass system accounted for the top 10 highest paid state employees, with administration and athletic personnel making up the majority of positions, and you can look for more reports coming out all month. We start with Frank Martin, UMass Amherst men's basketball coach. Martin was the highest paid state employee, with $2,180,000 in total take-home pay. Of that total, Martin made $925,000 in other pay on top of his $1,250,000 base salary. In his fourth year leading the team, Martin has led the Minutemen to a 9-5 record so far this season, following a lackluster 12-20 record in 2024. Next, Dr. Michael Collins, Chancellor of UMass Chan Medical School. He ranks second on the list with a total take-home pay of $1,570,000 last year. That included a base salary of $1,040,000 and $536,000 in so-called other pay. He's the longest-serving chancellor in the history of the UMass system, first being appointed in 2008 after serving for a year in an interim capacity. He is also the senior vice president for health sciences at UMass. Next is football coach, UMass football coach, Joe Harasimiak. Coach Harasimiak took home a total of $1,410,000 in 2025, which was a base salary of $1,150,000 with $260,000 in so-called other pay. UMass doesn't seem to be paying for much success. The third highest paid state employee delivered a last place finish for the Minutemen in the Mid-Atlantic Conference with a 6-12 record this past season. Next, we turn to Terrence Flott, or Float, F-L-O-T-T-E. He's provost and executive deputy chancellor, again, at the Chan Medical School of UMass. Dr. Float was paid a total of $1,180,000 last year, placing him as the fourth highest paid Massachusetts employee. He joined the medical school in 2007 from the University of Florida, where he was the Nemours Eminent Scholar and chair of the Department of Pediatrics for the College of Medicine, according to a UMass senior leadership page. Next, Partha Chakrabarty. He is also with the Chan Medical School. He's executive vice chancellor for innovation and business development. He's the final state employee on the list to take home over $1 million. He made a base salary of $690,129 last year, with an additional $316,928,000, and again in so-called other pay. He held a series of global business leadership roles in Fortune 500 companies and was among senior leadership at Boston's Vertex Pharmaceuticals before he joined UMass. Next is Ryan Bramford. He's UMass Athletic Director. He was the sixth highest paid state employee at 920, $912,226, which included a base salary of $712,226 and an extra $200,000 in other pay. He was hired in 2015, but UMass sports have seen limited success under his leadership. Next, we come to former Llewellyan Marty Meehan. Meehan brought home $879,454 in total pay, with a base pay of $735,621 and other pay as $143,833. That made him the seventh highest paid state employee. He was appointed president of the UMass system back in 2015 after serving as chancellor of UMass Lowell since 2007. Before joining UMass, the Democratic former congressman served in the House of Representatives from 1993 to 2007. He represented the 5th Congressional District. Next is again at the Chan Medical School, Lisa Colombo. She's Chancellor for Health Counseling. She brought in $821,872 in her role as Executive Vice Chancellor, with $641,872 as base salary, and again other pay as $180,000. She's also held additional executive roles within the UMass Memorial Healthcare System. Next was Javier Reyes. He's UMass Amherst Chancellor. He made $731,684 in total pay in 2025, leading the flagship campus of the UMass system, becoming the first Hispanic to do so. He made a base salary of $624,852, with $106,830 in, again, so-called other pay. Reyes has faced blowback from student groups and activists since he was appointed back in 2023 for ordering arrests of unruly anti-Israel protesters. In 2024, UMass Student Government Association delivered a vote of no confidence after he deployed Massachusetts State Police to remove an unauthorized encampment erected by anti-Israel protesters, which resulted in hundreds of arrests. Next is Donald Brown, former head football coach. Coach Brown isn't even working for UMass or any other state entity anymore, but back in 2025, he was still paid $705,440, making him the 10th highest paid state employee. He was actually fired in 2024 after amassing a disappointing 6-28 record over three seasons. Then we have the top paid employees not affiliated with UMass. The University of Massachusetts system, incredibly, makes up for the top 61 earners across the entire state, outpacing elected officials and all other departments. The highest paid non-US Mass affiliated employee in 2025 was Medical Director of the Veterans Home in Chelsea, Jed Barash, who made $416,103 in total pay. He had a base salary of $325,435 and had overtime of $88,500 and so-called other pay of $1,169. It does end by saying, send us your tips and your questions to joed@bostonherald.com, and that is joed@bostonherald.com. Send us your tips and your questions. Interesting. And still on the front page, we have a very large, actually two quite large, black and white photos of the Pawtucket Canal. First one is in front of the Swamp Locks Gatehouse that was taken just the other day, 2 days ago. And the other one shows a thin layer of snow coating the mostly drained Merrimack Canal, again taken 2 days ago. It says there's science behind who gets snow and who doesn't. It says if you ever wondered why it always snows in northern Massachusetts, but you drive an hour south and they're getting rain, you're not alone. According to meteorologist Bryce Williams with the National Weather Service in Norton, there are good reasons for it, and it's not just because you're on the Santa Naughty list. He says, when it comes to southern New England in general, we are repeatedly having to deal with the rain-snow line. The proximity to the ocean is the key factor. The water is cold, but it gets actually quite a bit warmer than the air is. Also, it all depends on the direction of the wind, and there are many more black and white photos, again, showing the Pawtucket Canal in various areas on January 2nd. It continues, low-pressure systems rotate counterclockwise, so while the typical wind pattern comes from west to east, when a low-pressure system comes up the coast, it circles the warmer, moist air of the water inland, which is why places like Boston usually get rain, and it's snowing just a little bit inland. But due to the higher elevation, colder air inland and wind from the west, the milder air coming off the water is no longer able to keep the temperature above 32 degrees, and the weather in Lowell and Fitchburg would actually come down as snow. Eventually, the moderating effect of the warmer air coming off the water lessens the further west and inland you go once you get into Middlesex County, Worcester County. The milder air can't compete with the colder temperatures, and it turns to snow. Williams said that for Fitchburg and Lowell, the air in a northeaster would have a lot of land to go over, which would have colder air in place, so the precipitation would end up being snow. And the higher the elevation, the colder it's going to be. The rain-snow line is always different and depends on the track of each storm. He continues, this year has been a colder winter than the last few years and resulting in several snowfalls in the northern regions of Massachusetts. But, he said, that's not a commentary on the climate as far as whether or not global warming exists. He continued, global warming doesn't mean we're not going to get cold in the winter. He said that overall, for the last 10 to 20 years, it's been up. It's been warmer on the whole. Tony Cambero of Fitchburg says he wasn't sure why it happened, saying that maybe the fact that Boston is a big city may have something to do with it, but that he appreciates the fact that Fitchburg is usually on the snowy side of the rain-snow line. He said, growing up, I didn't like the snow, but for my job, when it snows, we get busy. He works for Safelite, which is fixing broken carb windshields. When people start scraping their windshields, they notice the cracks. He says, and a small crack will expand when you run the heater. So it definitely gets busy when it snows. Cambero said he's actually noticed it snowing even more in Athol or Orange sometimes, and when he hits Gardner or Fitchburg coming east, it isn't snowing anymore. Well, I'm not sure, says Juan Hernandez of Fitchburg, probably because we're in the sticks out here, we're in the woods out here. He said he plows, so he's not complaining about the fact that Fitchburg is above, usually, the rain-snow line. He said, I love it. I like the snow. I just don't like the cold. I wish we could have the snow when it's a little bit warmer. But William said, no can do, as it has to be under 32 degrees to snow, as we're unfortunately finding out. And one more article still on the front page. Another little bit of misery about flu cases. This by Grace Zorkovich. She's also with the Herald. She gives her email address as gzorkovich, Z-O-K-O-V-I-T-C-H, at bostonherald.com. Flu cases in Boston and across Massachusetts are continuing to tick up as a new variant circulates, with public health officials reminding residents it's not too late to get vaccinated. State Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein on a WCVB segment that aired yesterday said that this flu season we're concerned about this new variant that's circulating. We saw it circulating in Europe, in Japan, in other parts of the world, and it's here in Massachusetts. Actually, this aired over a week ago, excuse me. In the most recent week reported ending December 27th, Massachusetts saw just over 8,800 lab-confirmed flu cases, which was up from about 7,200 the prior week and just under 3,200 2 weeks before, according to the state's flu dashboard. Flu activity in Massachusetts is categorized as very high by state officials, and flu severity reached high in the most recent week. Across the state, 9% of hospitalizations were related to influenza, compared to just 5% the week before. The data also shows 30 deaths related to flu this season. In Boston, cases rose to 748 in the most recent week reported, which was a slight uptick from 712 the week before. The city also reported 11.3% of emergency department visits for flu-like illness, which was up from 7.2% the prior week. The continued rise comes a week after Boston health officials warned of an early surge in flu cases this year, rising 114% in early December, and even higher increases for children's cases. The CDC has warned of a new flu variant, which is called Subclade K, that's S-U-B-C-L-A-D-E, Subclade K, spreading across the U.S. after rapidly growing across the United Kingdom, Japan, and Canada. Over half of the United States are reporting high or very high levels of illness, according to the CDC. The subclade K strain is a mutated version of one of the two subtypes of type A flu, H3N2, allowing it to evade some of the protection of the vaccine. H3N2 is typically harsh, especially in older adults. The CDC has stated that it's too soon to say how severe this season will be. Goldstein said that there's not a perfect match between this vaccine and the variant that's circulating, but he urged residents to get vaccinated anyway. He said it still provides significant protection, and we know this from other parts of the world where we've seen people who get vaccinated being protected. They're less likely to end up in the hospital, less likely to be out of work for a long period of time. The vaccine still works, and people should still get it. We go on from there to the next local news page. And at the top of the page, an article by Aaron Curtis. His email, acurtis@lowellsun.com. This is Dateline Stratford, New Hampshire. A 31-year-old Pelham, New Hampshire woman was hospitalized on New Year's Eve after losing control of a rental snowmobile and crashing on a remote trail in Stratford. New Hampshire Fish and Game said that medical crews from Groveton and Stratford responded to the West Side Road Trail. This was about 4:20 p.m. Wednesday, after another rider came upon the crash victim and found 31-year-old Jennifer Jasinski injured and called 911. The nearest conservation officer was on patrol in Dixville at the time and met with the victim later at the hospital because of the extended response time. Authorities said that an investigation determined that Ms. Jasinski lost control while navigating a downhill right-hand turn. The snowmobile left the trail, struck a tree, and ejected her over an embankment. Ms. Jasinski sustained an undetermined lower leg injury. She was evacuated by medical crews and transported to Weeks Medical Center in Lancaster, New Hampshire for treatment. Fish and Game investigators determined that Jasinski had little or no prior snowmobiling experience, calling inexperience the primary factor in her crash. Authorities used the incident to urge snowmobile riders to operate within their skill level and remain alert to early season trail conditions. We also have news from the Tewksbury Police of interest, this again by Aaron Curtis. This is about a system called Code Red, Dateline Tewksbury. Tewksbury Police Department is rolling out a new mass notification system after its previous alert platform called Code Red, which was by the group OnSolve, was decommissioned following a cyber attack and a data breach at the vendor level. The department announced in a press release Friday that the town has partnered with Regroup, which is a high-speed notification service capable of delivering urgent alerts and community updates through phone calls, text messages, emails, and other channels. The system will be used for both emergency warnings and routine notices, including road closures, trash pickup changes, and other time-sensitive information. OnSolve customers, including Tewksbury, lost access to Code Red on November 10, 2025, after a breach. The shutdown also resulted in agencies temporarily losing access to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, limiting their ability to issue rapid emergency notifications. The Code Red program had been a voluntary system allowing residents to sign up for emergency alerts, project updates, and other town notifications. The cyber attack exposed user data, including phone numbers, email addresses, and passwords, although the breach targeted the OnSolve Code Red system itself and did not compromise any Tewksbury police infrastructure. Because of the exposure, community members who used the same password for their Code Red account and other personal or business accounts have been urged to update those passwords. Police also warned residents that any messages claiming to be from Code Red on behalf of the department should be ignored and users should terminate the communication. The move to this new outfit called Regroup, said police, will allow the department to quickly target messages to specific neighborhoods or the entire community. But the system is only as effective as the contact information that it contains, and residents must register to ensure that they receive alerts. The department said that one reason they selected this company, Regroup, is because of its ability to let individuals and businesses add their own phone numbers and email addresses directly to the system. Those with unlisted numbers, or people who rely on cell phones or voice over internet protocol, and anyone who has changed their address or phone number in the past year, is encouraged to sign up. Registration requires a name, a physical address, and a primary phone number, with the option to add additional numbers and email addresses. A street address is necessary so the system can deliver geographically targeted alerts during emergencies. Residents can enroll online by visiting TewksburyPolice.com. TewksburyPolice.com, exactly as it sounds. And those without internet access can call the Tewksbury Police Department, 978-640-4380, 978-640-4380. Police stress that all information collected will be used solely for emergency notification purposes. And yet one more note here on the local page. We have a large color photo here of Republican Governor of New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte, as she signs two bills into law back in May 2025 that ban sanctuary cities for that granite state. It's got a number of people with her, but she is the only one identified. This, again, by Tim Dunn of the Herald that I mentioned before. His email address, tim.dunn, D-U-N-N, at bostonherald.com. It says sanctuary cities are officially banned in New Hampshire as a set of laws signed by Republican Governor Kelly Ayotte in May took effect now while the country celebrated its transition into 2026. According to the governor, New Hampshire has made it clear that we are not a sanctuary for criminals and we will not go the way of Massachusetts and their billion-dollar illegal immigration crisis. We will continue to work to keep our state the safest in the nation. End quote. The legislation filed in the New Hampshire House, an act relative to cooperation with federal immigration authorities, HB 511, prohibits cities and towns from adopting sanctuary policies to prohibit or impede the enforcement of federal immigration law. It also prohibits blanket policies against compliance with immigration detainees and bans local governments and New Hampshire police agencies from withholding inmate immigration information from the federal law enforcement. The bill also bans New Hampshire police agencies from investigating an inmate's citizenship status. The Senate version of the legislation was also signed by Ayotte, called an act relative to law enforcement participation in a federal immigration program and relative to cooperation with federal immigration authorities. It's SB 62. This legislation specifically strips state and local governments authority to ban law enforcement entities from entering into voluntary agreements with ICE. State Representative Joe Sweeney, who's from Salem, co-sponsored the House legislation and tells the Herald that the sanctuary city ban is long overdue in New Hampshire. Quoting him, for years, Democrats have looked the other way while federal immigration laws were ignored, putting public safety at risk and forcing local taxpayer to shoulder the consequences. This law makes one thing clear. New Hampshire will not be a safe haven for criminals, and our state and local law enforcement will cooperate fully with federal authorities. If you are here illegally and commit a crime, you should expect to be held accountable, not protected by political policies. End quote. Two New Hampshire municipalities, Hanover and Lebanon, had previously been self-declared sanctuary cities until the Department of Homeland Security added them to a list of sanctuary jurisdictions defying federal immigration law and demanded that they change policy. Both have since changed their immigration policies to cooperate with federal immigration officials. While the state's Democratic Party and federal delegation have remained silent on the new laws taking effect, New Hampshire House Republicans didn't shy away from celebrating, boasting about the added public safety benefits that come with the new laws. Apparently, there's a sign, "So long, sanctuary cities." It says, "New Hampshire is safer than it was before, thanks to an anti-sanctuary act that takes effect today. Our state will no longer fall prey to the chaos and lawlessness of sanctuary city policies." The Republican caucus of New Hampshire's House of Representatives posted this Thursday on X, and it says, "Republicans kept New Hampshire and your family safe." The ban on sanctuary cities in the Granite State comes amid rumors that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE as we call it, is planning on utilizing a vacant warehouse in Merrimack, New Hampshire, as a detainee processing facility that could hold up to 1,500 people. This is Fran continuing the Saturday Sun from January 3rd, and we read the opinion page editorial entitled "Rent Control Not Part of Healey's Affordability Plan." By action rather than words, Governor Healey previously has indicated that rent control isn't an effective way to combat the high housing cost, a burden borne by too many residents of this state. The legislature and Ms. Healey partnered in 2024 to pass a major new housing production law, an initiative that didn't include rent control proposals. The governor's capital investment plan for fiscal years 2026 to 2030 calls for housing investments totaling $2.34 billion. The administration contends that funding in fiscal 2026 will drive down housing costs by helping to create more than 6,000 new units. Since a 1994 voter law banned rent control in Massachusetts, bills brought forward to overturn that statute have continually stalled in the legislature. The latest legislative attempt, a bill by Senator Pat Jehlen, that's J-E-H-L-E-N, Democrat from Somerville, would enable cities and towns to limit rent increases to the rate of inflation and have a cap of 5%. It also bans no-fault evictions. Jehlen's proposal includes exemptions for owner-occupied buildings with four or fewer units, public and subsidized housing, college dorms, newly constructed buildings for 5 years, and facilities that provide residential elderly care. But now a referendum proposing that course has advanced closer to a place on the 2026 state ballot. The Secretary of State's office announced in mid-December that it certified 88,132 signatures for that petition, which was 13,000 more than was required, which supporters say will put the brakes on unfettered rent increases. Rent control is one of five ballot measures that have been certified so far this cycle. Eligible petitions will be filed as bill by the first legislature, of the new year, which will be January 7th, lawmakers will then get a chance to address those petitions themselves or let the questions go before voters in November. The ballot initiative proposes a limit on annual rent hikes for most units to either the annual consumer price index increase or 5%, whichever is lower. The measure would use the rent in place for any one unit as of January 31st, 2026 as a baseline for future changes. While Healy has highlighted the now enacted ban on renters paid broker's fee as an accomplishment to save renters thousands, she draws the line at rent control. She recently stated that unequivocally on Boston Public Radio, asked by host Jim Brandy about whether she'd support the ballot measure, she said, "Look, I understand the need, the interest in rent control, right? I mean, it's why I've worked really, really hard, Jim, to build as many houses as I can," unquote. On the radio, Healy alluded to a 220,000-unit housing shortage Massachusetts faced at the start of her time in the corner office. It said that the state has so far started or built 100,000 homes. She attempted to create conditions that encourage construction of housing, something she believes rent control would discourage. Quoting her again, "We've got more work to do, but I'm trying to do everything I can to drive down housing costs, which drives down housing prices, but also rent. My concern, you know, rent control is not going to be the solution to how we get through this crisis. We need to build more homes." I'm a no, because if you look at the studies, you effectively halt production. I will tell you that investors in housing have already pulled out of Massachusetts because they're concerned about rent control. End of quote. But rent control supporters point to the ballot initiative as a way to help improve housing stability, as well as protect small landlords. Noemi Ramos, who is New England Community Project Executive Director, said at a rally in November that "we do understand that housing costs and building housing is expensive, but that does not mean that we take away the accountability that developers and large corporate landlords have around where they're building housing. We care about development coming into the neighborhood. We're not anti-development. We want to see the stronger development without displacement strategies in place across the Commonwealth as new housing is being built," end quote. But Tony Lopez with the Small Property Owners Association contended that Yellen's bill reaches for the wrong tool. He cited rent control lessons from San Francisco and New York City, which he claimed led to the loss of rental units and discouraged investment and maintenance. Those two cities also continue to have the highest rental cost in the nation. According to a national rent report from Zumper, that's Z-U-M-P-E-R, the median price for a one-bedroom apartment in New York stood in July at $4,450, far surpassing second place San Francisco at $3,400. "This bill," he said again, "may be well-intentioned, but the outcome will have fewer available units, deteriorating housing conditions, and owners walking away from reinvestment in all the housing stock that needs scarce." So again, we're talking about Mr. Lopez. "So we agree," says the editorial, "with Mr. Lopez and the governor. Rent control isn't the answer to the state's chronic lack of availability and affordability. It would likely discourage the creation of more rental units in existing housing and curb developers' appetite to produce new rental units, thus further exacerbating a chronic shortfall." And one more article in the front pages of Saturday's Sun, this time from the Nation section. It's an Associated Press-authored article with a photo of a December 31st picture of a classroom called the ABC Learning Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with children watching television. It says Minnesota officials have until next week to provide the Trump administration with information about providers and parents who receive federal child care funds, or they risk losing potentially millions of dollars in federal funding. In an email sent Friday to child care providers shared with the Associated Press by multiple providers, Minnesota's Department of Children, Youth, and Families said that it has until January 9th to provide a set of verifying information about recipients. The announcement earlier this week by the Trump administration said that it would freeze child care funds to Minnesota and the rest of the states, which comes after a series of fraud schemes at Minnesota daycare centers, many of them run by Somali residents. The move came after a right-wing influencer, a so-called right-wing influencer, alleged that there were widespread abuses. The Administration for Children and Families, a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, provides $185 million in child care funds annually just to Minnesota. The email instructed providers and families who rely on the frozen federal child care program to continue the program's licensing and certification requirements and practices as usual. It does not say that recipients themselves need to take any action or provide any information. The email said, "We recognize the alarm and question that this has raised. We found out about the freezing of funds at the same time everyone else did on social media." The state agency added that it did not receive a formal communication from the federal government until late Tuesday night, which was after Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary Jim O'Neill posted about the freeze on social media X. All 50 states will have to provide additional levels of verification and administrative data before they receive more funding from the Child Care and Development Fund, which is designed to make child care affordable for low-income families. The U.S. House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform will hold a hearing Wednesday to discuss allegations of fraudulent use of federal funds in Minnesota. A spokesman said that the child care fraud hotline put up by the federal agency earlier this week has received more than 200 tips. Minnesota has drawn the ire from Republicans and the administration over other fraud accusations. Administration for Children and Families Assistant Secretary Alex Adams told Fox News on Friday that his agency sent Minnesota a letter last month asking for information on the child care program and other welfare programs by December 26, but didn't get any response. The state did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Small Business Administration Administrator Kelly Loeffler, that's L-O-E-F-L-E-R, posted on X that the agency suspended 6,900 Minnesota borrowers of COVID-19-era loans because of suspected fraud. The president has also targeted the state's large Somali community with immigration enforcement actions and called them garbage. Minnesota Democrats say that the administration is playing politics and hurting families and children as a result. Minnesota's Department of Children, Youth, and Families said in a press release last Friday that inspectors conduct regular oversight activity for the child care program, and they noted that there are 55 related open investigations involving providers. It also said that investigators did spot checks and reviews on 9 centers and found that they were operating as expected. One center was not yet open at the time. The Department of Children and Youth and Families remains committed to fact-based reviews that stop fraud, protect children, support families, and minimize disruption to communities that rely on these essential services, said the department. Distribution of unvetted or deceptive claims and misuse of tip lines can interfere with investigations, create safety risk for families, providers, and employers, and has contributed to harmful discourse about Minnesota's immigrant communities. Maria Snyder, who's the director of a child care center in St. Paul, Minnesota, and vice president of advocacy group called Minnesota Child Care Association, said that providers currently get paid at least 3 weeks after services are provided. Some 23,000 children and 12,000 families receive funding from the targeted child care program every month, on an average, according to the state. She said, "For a lot of centers, we're already running on a thin margin. Even centers where 10 to 15% of their kids are on child care assistance, that's a dip in your income," end quote. Any child who attends a childcare center with attendees who receive federal funding could be impacted, according to Snyder. According to Friday email from Minnesota's Department of Children, Youth, and Families, they sent a letter to Minnesota asking for data from 2022 to 2025, including identifying information of all recipients of child care funds, a list of all providers who receive the funds, how much they receive, and information related to alleged fraud networks and oversight failures. It's unclear whether Minnesota already has the data that the administration is asking for. The House of Homeland Security said that 5 child care centers that received funds from the child care program or temporary assistance for needy families, that's another program, would have to provide specific documentation, such as attendance, inspections, and assessments, according to what was written in the email.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.